It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is the final day of voting in Wisconsin and around the country. Polls are open in the state until 8 o'clock tonight. We are taking a break from covering the candidates and campaigns this morning as people cast their ballots. But WPR will bring you live special coverage of the election starting tonight at 6, and I hope you can join us. Now, the gap between CEO and average worker pay has skyrocketed in past decades. A recent analysis by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel examines the pay ratio between Wisconsin chief executives in 2023 and median worker wages. They found compensation packages for CEOs who run Wisconsin's 25 largest public companies is hundreds, even thousands of times greater than the workers with salaries that make up the middle of these firms' pay scales. Here to discuss CEO pay ratios is Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the High Road Strategy Center, that's an economic think tank, and Clinical Associate Professor at the Sandra Rosenbaum School of Social Work at UW-Madison. Laura, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Laura, what jumps out to you as you look at this CEO data?
I mean, I think we probably all know in our heads that CEOs earn a lot of money. I think the thing that really jumps out at me is just the ratio, the growth in the distance between what a CEO and what a worker earns. And this is true in Wisconsin. You mentioned, the highest ratio is over 1,000 times between the highest compensation of the CEO to the median worker. And that's true nationally as well. These gaps are enormous, and they're much bigger than they were even 20 years ago.
And an example might be Kohl's CEO, Tom Kingsbury, making $8.9 million in 2023, that pay package. Median employee salary at Kohl's was around $12,000 a year. I wonder, are there particular sectors where we see wider gaps than other industries?
I think it's hard for me to say that. It's certainly the case that the very biggest gaps generated in Wisconsin were for both Kohl's, where the median worker's earning just $12,000 a year. That's a pretty low median wage. And also Manpower Group, where the median worker, the median pay is under $10,000 a year. So it's definitely the case that with a lower wage industry, sometimes the ratios can look quite large. And so part of what's going on is these lower wage industries. But there are some other examples, an electronics manufacturing, Fiserv Forum, with gigantic ratios that don't have that kind of same story.
We'll step back for a moment and give us some historical context. With the gap between CEO and worker pay, it's increased dramatically since the 70s. What are the reasons?
I think the financial is, sometimes people call this the financialization of the American economy, but CEOs and corporate boards shifted to a model of stock and ownership in the company as rewards for work, rather than in the 1970s, CEOs largely earned salaries, very high salaries like everyone else. But salaries like everyone else. And then shifted to a much more financially driven shareholder, kind of stock returns driven model that has really exploded their pay, even as workers at the median, really haven't seen those gains. So one of the expressions of this from 1978 to now, CEO compensation has risen by 1,000%. And the typical worker's wage is up about 15%.
Do you think our corporate boards even concerned about pay gaps? If, as you said, they're concerned about retaining that CEO when they see their earnings go up, is that more of the focus here?
Obviously, I think there is concern about keeping good managers. There's also, I think, a lot of evidence or some strong evidence from the Economic Policy Institute that shareholders or the stock values are being driven by things outside of CEO choice, and CEOs are getting rewarded for that when and so it isn't that there's a perfect alignment between share value in the short term and the potential of the company. And the financialization really focuses folks on this like high return strategies in the short term. And I think that can undermine the longer term growth. But also over the course of the last 40 years, when this has happened, the structures that we have to decrease the incentive for this to happen, higher tax rates on higher earners, tax rate, you know, actually taxing these sorts of compensation, not just wage compensation, that policy has gone away. And so it's pushed people into rewarding themselves or through control of a board, these higher wages.
We're talking about CEO worker pay gaps and an analysis by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on CEO compensation in our state. Laura Dresser is here, Associate Director of an Economic Think Tank at UW-Madison. Laura, looking at these 25 publicly traded companies, one thing stands out. Not a single woman CEO here. Everyone is led by a man. What research insights can you offer about women in the C-suite and in the workforce? Because you do have the State of Working Wisconsin report that you put out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in a lot of ways, the State of Working Wisconsin is really focusing on the other side, the denominator, or the, you know, like what is the median worker entering in these? And I think it's important to see that like you're noticing in the C-suite, dominated by men, or you know, overwhelmingly in Wisconsin, in the top 25, all men. And the workers that carry the work in the lower wage jobs, disproportionately women, and the kind of rewards going to the top, growing and growing. And I think this, so for me, this really relates to what we think about a lot in the State of Working Wisconsin is how do we improve jobs at the bottom of the labor market? How do we make, that kind of lift the floor for the bulk of workers rather than, you know, kind of continuing to move into these astronomical pays for CEOs? Like, what is the strategies that move up the bottom and how do we get some taxes and incentive away back to longer term economic growth rather than short term gains?
Yeah. Can you expand on that? What are some solutions to curb this trend?
Well, I think, you know, at the top end, the, higher tax rates on very top income earners is at the state level, higher tax rates on the very top. We've moved away from that over the last 20 years. And tax incentive, tax policy could incentivize lower or more equal pay or lower ratios, more attention to the ratio. So that kind of what is the median earner earning? And then antitrust legislation, because part of when we have this kind of concentration of companies, fewer and fewer companies with higher and higher rewards in the stock markets, you know, so competition could actually kind of help spread that out. And so antitrust policy, the kind that the FTC is pursuing, is also kind of part of the picture on the high end. And then on the low end, or on the kind of where, I don't mean to call it low, but, you know, like where people work, you know, thinking more about what is our enforcement of our minimum wage? What is the number of honor? What is our minimum wage? What is our ability for workers to form unions and to pursue their own interests? These things kind of help workers make a stronger claim on the wages that on the value that that company is generating, but not delivering to workers.
One more note here. The Journal Sentinel's data only looking at publicly traded companies that submit their data to the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission. Could you predict or extrapolate what could be happening with the CEO pay ratios at privately held companies?
It's a great question. And, you know, obviously this not public data. The reason, you know, we can say these things for certain about CEO pay is because they're publicly traded, because they are required to say what CEOs earn and private companies are not. I think you know, an economist such as myself would say it's a market. And so with high CEO pay in the public side, the private, you know, the private side is competing against that. And so you would see some, you would likely see some similar things, though I think that some people, you know, argue that privately held companies sometimes are taking longer, more locally rooted timelines. But I don't know on net what that would be true.
One note about your State of Working Wisconsin report in 2024, it found median wages surged in 2023, matching the fastest one-year increase dating back to 1979. Did CEO wages see a similar jump?
Well, that surge was almost $1 an hour. It nearly made up for the hit that inflation took out of wages in 2022. Mm. So it moved the median wage in this state to almost $21 an hour. So it was strong wage growth and stronger than we'd posted in a long time. But that's the kind of wage growth that gets you a dollar a year. The CEO compensation growth growing 1,000 times over the last 20 years is just a better. They're definitely posting a much higher rate of wage growth than workers are.
Well, Laura, appreciate your context here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Laura Dresser is Associate Director of the High Road Strategy Center. That's an economic think tank. It's based at UW-Madison. And she talked with us about the widening pay gap between CEOs and their employees and this recent analysis by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on CEO compensation. Coming up, a Wisconsin father is still seeking information about the police shooting that killed his son 20 years ago. He and a journalist joined the show for a look at the latest court setback and what's at stake.
If we went back and looked at it, not to seek out blame, but to prevent people from being harmed in the future, I think that would be valuable for society.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On November 9th, it will have been 20 years since Michael Bell Jr. was killed in an officer-involved shooting in Kenosha. Since his son's death in 2004, Michael Bell Sr. has been working to uncover the events of that night. In 2022, as part of his pursuit for more information, he filed a complaint against Attorney General Josh Call and Tina Virgil, the state's former criminal investigation administrator. He said they violated his rights as a crime victim by declining to order the release of relevant evidence and information. The state's Crime Victims' Rights Board ruled against him, saying the state was the victim in the case, though that decision will face more court challenges. Joe Neff is an investigative reporter at the Marshall Project. He recently published a feature detailing Bell's case. He and Michael Bell Sr. talked to Rob Ferret last week.
Michael, I think we need to start with the story of the loss of your son. I've talked to you. Can you recount that for us? Remind us what happened just about 20 years ago in Kenosha.
My son was coming home from a night out with friends. He arrived in front of his home. An officer pulled up behind him. Eventually, the officer got out of the car. My son got out of the car. There were some words exchanged. My son ran to the back of the house. To make a long story short, we believe an officer hooked his gun on a car mirror, and he misinterpreted it as my son. And while my son was bent over a car in handcuffs, another officer came up to him and put a gun directly to his temple and fired a bullet into my son's head while my daughter and his mother watched from just 10 feet away.
And Michael, you've told me in the past and others that at the time you were not the sort of person who would doubt a police account of an event like this. You grew to doubt it very much over time. Can you talk about what led you to a question and then start challenging and investigating the police account of what happened?
I need your listeners to understand that I'm a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. I flew wars for our country, and I had so much honor and integrity in my own uniform that I expected those in government around me to have the same. When I heard my daughter recount the version of what she saw that night, I couldn't believe it. I didn't even believe my own child. But trying to keep my family put together, we went to counseling. And during deep counseling sessions with Michael's mother and myself and my daughter, I recognized that these ladies were telling the absolute truth. And about that same time, other evidence was coming in to show that the police version of the shooting was inaccurate.
Joe, you've covered stories related to police and prison accountability in the past. What drew you to write for the Marshall Project about Michael Bell Sr. and his latest legal efforts?
Well, the thing that initially drew me to this, there is a certain man bites dog quality. I received a phone call from someone who told me that there's a man whose son was killed by police in Wisconsin, and it went to the state victims' rights board, which ruled that if there was a victim in this case, it wasn't Mr. Bell, it was the government. And that was really bizarre to me because I've been following the victims' rights movement through my work for decades now, and I've never heard that the government is a victim in a crime.
And Michael, let's pick up the story there. As part of your effort to get at all relevant records, get at every possible angle on what happened in November 20 years ago, you filed a complaint, this is a couple of years ago, against Attorney General Josh Call and Tina Virgil, the state's criminal investigation administrator, saying that your rights as a victim had been violated. Can you talk about that legal angle, that legal avenue you're pursuing?
It all started with a local DA telling a judge when we requested a John Doe hearing that the state crime lab had verified his position that they didn't expect to see any DNA on the officer's gun. And we were like, are you telling me that the first DA said that there was a life and death struggle, that essentially my son was supposedly grabbing an officer's weapon and there was no DNA? And so we asked for the records on who that crime analyst was for the Department of Justice, and Josh Call refused to turn over any of that information. So I went to Governor Evers. I contacted him, and he said there was nothing he could do, but his senior legal counsel at the time suggested that we make a complaint with the Crimes Victims Rights Board. And that's how it started. At the time that Marcy's Law came into being, crime victims had actually less rights than the people that committed the crime. Marshall's Law ensures that victims of a crime have equal constitutional rights on the same level as those accused and convicted of the crime. So we made a complaint with the Crimes Victims Rights Board. And then the ruling at the end come out and said that we were not the victim of a crime, but the government, even though there might have been police misconduct, is the victim of a crime.
Joe, as you mentioned, you followed these victims' rights laws. How unique is this case, this challenge from Michael invoking Wisconsin's version of victims' rights law, Marcy's Law, as he just mentioned?
I have not heard of a case like this where the government is the victim. The victims' rights movement started because police and prosecutors were ignoring victims, that the only role that a victim would have in court was to be a witness. And it was victim's job to show up in court and testify. But that did not recognize the humanity of what crime victims have gone through. So over time, states have all passed some sort of victims' rights laws, but you have the right to know what's going on in the case. Has someone been charged? What is the investigation showing? If there's a court hearing, you have the right to be heard. You have the right to input. And none of those rights applies to the government. I've called around to a lot of law professors, and it seems to be that no victims' rights board or agency has issued something like this elsewhere.
We are talking about victims' rights in the case of Michael Bell Jr., shot fatally by Kenosha police just shy of 20 years ago. His father, Michael Bell Sr., is with us. Also, Joe Neff, investigative reporter at the Marshall Project. Michael, this ruling is not the last word, as I understand it. What will you do now to try to invoke your rights as a victim and to try to get this information?
Right now, we have an interested pro bono attorney that's going to take the appeal on this to the next step. And so that's why it should be headed to the Court of Appeals very shortly.
Michael, if the court system ends up agreeing with you, saying, yes, you are the victim of a crime, of what you say is a cover-up by police and others, what then will you be able to do with that? What are your hopes for the ability then to get more of the information you've been looking for all these years?
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up, Rob, because one of the most important pieces of evidence right now is being held closely by the city of Kenosha. The bullet that was involved with killing my son wants to be investigated by a national renowned ballistics expert. We found the bullet in impact location. It is in direct opposition to the police version of the shooting. That bullet impact location tested positive for lead. We feel that if we have the bullet, we can match it to that bullet impact location, and it's going to completely blow the police version of the story apart, but the city refuses to release the bullet. I want to tell you, I went as far as to offer a financial indemnification agreement that if something was found because of that, the city would be found harmless. I went as far as to offer $200,000 to Kenosha charities if the city of Kenosha will release that bullet for outside examination, and the city of Kenosha refuses. There aren't really any regulations regarding evidence. A police department can discard evidence anytime they want to. And the problem is what happens if they discard evidence that might be incriminating against that police department? So we're very, very worried that that bullet is not going to be preserved. And so Friday the 1st, one of our investigators is a retired police detective. His name is Russell Beckman. He will be at the public safety building in Kenosha doing a records review of the whole matter. And along with him will be a process server. And that process server will be giving the Public Works and Joint Services an order asking for preservation of that bullet. And so it is a big event. And we have no idea how the city's going to respond. Are they going to welcome us in? They're going to shoo us away? We don't know, but we're going to be taking a look at all the records associated with my son's death and that bullet. I believe that if this comes in our favor, then we can bring this to a new John Doe, and we can eventually get that bullet investigated properly.
Joe, as you've mentioned, this is in some ways a very unique case when it comes to victims' rights laws, but as Michael has suggested, there could be a lot at stake for future issues, especially when somebody in government could be accused of a crime. What do you see as being at stake in this particular court challenge?
One of the things that is at stake is the ability of someone like Michael Bell to tell a prosecutor or police or a city what to do, or to win that right to have the city share the bullet so that it can be forensically examined. A lot of the rights that have been recognized are rights to speak and be heard for victims. So this is very interesting. Do I have a right to tell the police or the city what to do?
And Joe, stepping away from the particulars of the case, is there a concern about police department transparency? When this information is there, there's maybe a public interest in seeking it and having it released. Is this something that you think has some wider lessons?
Oh, yes. If you think about all the cases where people are shot and killed by police, oftentimes these are wrongful, even criminal uses of force. A crime victim or the person's family should have the right to get all of the information about what happened that day to prevent these type of things from happening in the future and to hold the wrongdoers accountable.
Michael, I want to revisit some of our past conversations. Of course, over the last 20 years, you've been pursuing the full story of what happened to your son. You've been doing more than that, too, largely because of your efforts, in some cases in partnership with others. Laws in Wisconsin have been changed. Rules have been changed when it comes to how police-involved shootings are investigated. Can you remind us some of the changes that have happened, in large part because of your efforts?
Well, I was appalled when I found out that the police department that was involved in the shooting actually investigated it itself. And I talked to current law enforcement today, and they can't believe that that was actually a rule that they could live by. As a retired military officer and a pilot, if my squadron crashed an aircraft, our squadron would do its own internal review, but it would never conduct the safety investigation. So I worked very hard with a number of other advocates, and in 2013, the law was changed, and Wisconsin became the first state in the nation that required all fatal police-involved shootings to be investigated by an outside agency. And another thing that we worked on is that I always felt that police-involved shootings should be reviewed like the National Transportation Safety Board reviews on aircraft mishap. What should happen is look at what happened, all the underlying causes, and if something could be changed, let's do it so that way that the accident doesn't happen again. Our investigative team strongly believes that a holster that a police officer wore that had what was called a jacket gap, so the jacket could fit between his gun and his utility belt. It's U-shaped, and it perfectly fit over a driver's side mirror. If they had the NTSB model of review, they would go back to the drawing board and say, wait a minute, this utility belt, the way it's designed, could be misinterpreted, and somebody could lose their life over it, whether it be a police officer or a civilian. So we were able to have a major conference at Wingspread, S.C. Johnson, with law enforcement and National Transportation Safety Board and NASA, and we talked about this open-type review. And those are just some of the things that we've been involved with. The last count that I heard, 8 other states have now adopted a version of the Wisconsin law requiring outside investigation of police shootings.
Joe, what are you watching for next in Michael's story?
Well, I'm waiting to see how the city of Kenosha will respond, unless they have decided not to share the bullet for review. But I think that since they are a government that responds to the voters, I would hope that at some point that might be revisited. There is no harm that I can see in examining a bullet and giving it to forensic evidence to see what the facts are. As a journalist, the more information in the public, the better. The more transparency for police and law enforcement, the better. And I do think that this idea that Michael's talking about convening real investigations like the National Transportation Safety Board does in airplane accidents would be really useful, because the whole goal is to prevent future accidents. And I think that in police shootings or in wrongful convictions, which are every wrongful conviction is a plane crash in and of itself, so to speak, that if we went back and looked at it, not to seek out blame, but to prevent people from being harmed in the future, I think that would be valuable for society.
Michael, you're still trying to correct the record, find the full story from 20 years ago. Do you feel like, in part because of those law changes you mentioned, a shooting today, God forbid, if it were to happen, would be investigated more fully? There would be more transparency.
I believe so. There's a lot of loose ends. You know, you can have reciprocal agreements between the police departments. I know that when our law came into effect, that some of the police departments said, you know, we're never going to let such and such police department investigate us because we don't trust them. We don't like them. So we are going to pick out a friendly department. So I do think there's improvement. One of the things that I think is important with the National Transportation Safety Board style investigation is right now the numbers show that approximately 35% of police-involved shootings are mistake of fact. Something was misperceived, and somebody died over it. And if we do a proper national transportation safety tile investigation, we might be able to bring that number down to 20% or 15%. And each time that we do that, we help the relationship between law enforcement and the community. We build better trust. And that's why I think it's so important that we continue to push forward with these types of reforms.
Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Michael Bell Sr., a victims' rights activist and former Air Force pilot. He's the father of Michael Bell Jr., who was killed by Kenosha police in 2004. Joe Neff is an investigative reporter at the Marshall Project. That's a criminal justice journalism nonprofit. His feature about Bell's case was published in collaboration with WPR. Wisconsin Public Radio is bringing you live special coverage this election night. You can join us tonight starting at 6. We'll share results and analysis from Wisconsin's biggest races as they come in and NPR updates from across the country. After the polls close in Wisconsin at 8, join my Wisconsin Today colleague Rob Ferret and WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. They will be anchoring our state's election coverage and keep you up to date on returns. Again, that's live coverage on this election night here on WPR and at WPR.org. Join us starting at 6. Coming up, a genealogy series in Eau Claire explores what happens when family history research turns up unsettling news about the past.
It's important to me to know that I have that ancestor who went through some probably pretty horrific things.
Uncomfortable discoveries about ancestors, that conversation is just ahead on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new series at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire is called Dirty Laundry, The Dark Side of Genealogy. Guest speakers will present information on researching your family history and what happens when it leads to an uncomfortable discovery about your ancestors. How do you find information on an estranged family member when there are little records to be found? And what do you do if that search ends in more questions than answers? Anne Lowry is author of the novel The Blue Trunk, which is based on the experiences of her great-great-aunt Marit, and is one of the speakers in the series. Anne, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Kate. I'm happy to be here.
Your book is dedicated to Marit Sletmo with a birth year of 1886. What made you want to look into her story?
Well, my mother had her travel trunk when she immigrated from Norway, and her name was written in perfect calligraphy on the outside. And I was kind of like that name, Marit. I thought it was really pretty. And so when my daughter was born, I told my mother I wanted to name her Marit. And my mother said, oh, no, you can't do that. Marit was insane. Mm. So I didn't name her Marit, but it kind of hung with me through the years. And I kept thinking about what happened to Marit. So a few years ago, I started doing some genealogy research. And Marit had immigrated with my great-great-grandmother, her sister. And I was able to find a lot of information on her, you know, from census data and death certificate, marriage certificate, that kind of thing. But I couldn't find anything on Marit, but I knew that she had come because, well, we had the trunk. And also I had an autograph book that she had signed that was given to my great aunt. It was Henry. I don't know who Henry was. It was his autograph book, but Marit had signed it. That was in Trempealeau, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. in 1889. So I knew that she was here. So I started to do some research then on insane asylums and found out that often people who were in asylums weren't counted in the census. They weren't often given death certificates. And many times they were buried in unknown graves. And then I found this cemetery in my hometown, Eau Claire, which I had no idea was there, that was attached to the old asylum. And they had many unknown graves there. So I concluded that perhaps she had lived there, had died there, was buried in an unknown grave. And that made me really sad. And so I wanted to reclaim her story. And so I thought, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a novel and reclaim Marit.
I so love that aspect of the story, and also that this trunk is on display in your foyer, that you keep it in your life and her presence with you.
Yeah, that's really important to me. And it, of course, after the book, it's even more important to me. I mean, the book is mostly fiction because, as I said, I ran into some barriers fairly quickly to find out what happened to her. But, you know, what she went through and what women in those days went through, and in fact, all people who were in asylums went through, you know, I like to keep that sort of close to me and appreciate how grateful I am, how far we've come dealing with mental health issues. And honestly, I'm not even sure she had mental health issues because a lot of people were put in asylums, especially women with hysteria, even though they weren't technically mentally ill. So I like to keep that close. I look at it every day. I see it every time I go in and out of my house. And it's important to me to know that I have that ancestor who went through some probably pretty horrific things.
It seems like some of your family members kind of erased the aunt after she was put into an institution for people with mental illness. What was that like, discovering you had this, you know, troubling family past?
Well, frankly, it wasn't surprising. My sort of understanding side of it is that they were Norwegian immigrants. They wanted to fit in. And mental illness in those days was definitely seen as a shameful thing in a family. But I also know, having grown up with her, let's see, her nieces and nephews, it would have been because my great-grandmother had died before I was born. They were very much into social status and social standing. Mm. And it didn't surprise me really to find out that, you know, my mother couldn't even mention her, talk about her. And my mother said, oh, I wish I would have asked more questions about her. But, you know, those were times when people were just, they were erased and their existence was erased. And I've had people contact me through my website sharing similar stories of ancestors that they had as well.
The series at the Eau Claire Library is called Dirty Laundry, and wondering how the notion or the idea of dirty laundry, of shameful history, how that has changed over time. What are your thoughts?
I didn't come up with the title for that. That was the library's. But I think that, you know, shows like Roots, a better understanding of generational trauma, has helped us all and people be more interested in ancestry, you know, ancestry.com, those kinds of things, I think have helped us sort of look or be more interested in our past and where we came from. And, you know, I think there are different ways that people can deal with it. One thing I will say about doing genealogy research is if you find something like this, first of all, make sure that you think that the information is actually truthful. In my case, as I did a lot of research on women in institutions in the early 1900s, as I mentioned, a lot of them were diagnosed with hysteria, which, frankly, the list of symptoms is so long. Any human being could have been diagnosed with hysteria. Mm-hmm. Any of us today could be diagnosed with it. And it was a way that they put people in, you know, especially women were put away in institutions. A friend of mine has found in her history that her great uncle was accused of murder and convicted of murder. But if you come from a background where you have been mistreated, you know, if you're a person of color and historically you've been mistreated by the justice system, just because you find someone who maybe had some criminal activity doesn't necessarily mean that was true. Maybe they were unjustly accused and unjustly imprisoned. So the first thing I think is to step back a little bit and say, okay, what is, you know, is this true? Is this accurate information? And then from there, I think people have a couple options. They can go forward and with that information and, you know, forget about it or sort of own it as part of where they came from, or, you know, they can do something with it. In my case, I decided to try to change the generational piece of that for me, which was to write historical fiction, but people can do things like, you know, write in their journal and say, what do I wish that my family history had been instead of this? Or, you know, write a short story, or if you're not into writing, you know, do an art piece or anything that I think in your own mind can replace or kind of retell the story, because that can be very healing, which writing this book was for me.
Hmm. What did you learn about the Eau Claire County Asylum and Poor Farm? What was the poor farm aspect of it?
Yeah, it was where indigent people went, and they worked on the farm and came up with produce. They had gardens, and then they sold it to the public. The asylum part was, of course, for mentally ill people. I understand, I've been told that the closure of the asylum began in the 1980s, and by 2015, none of it remained. But, you know, until then, it was actively used as an insane asylum and a poor farm. I found a report that was written by the superintendent in 1931. The medical doctor at the time has a short report in there about the people who were there, and he calls them inmates. Mm. And I was so struck by that because I thought, oh, that's telling about what happened there. I have talked to a woman who worked there later, and she said that people were treated very well and with respect and dignity, but she worked there later. I suspect in the early years that wasn't the case.
We're talking about discovering what happens when your family research leads to an uncomfortable discovery about ancestors. Anne Lowry is with us, author of the new novel, The Blue Trunk. And there's this opening scene in your novel about the family that is, you know, there's a fire sweeping across the island in Norway. How much do you know about the circumstances of Marit coming to this country and what she might endured in the passing, going from home country to the new country?
Well, the story of the fire is accurate. That's historically accurate. However, Marit wasn't a part of that fire. That's fiction.
Okay.
But I can tell you that the research I did on the voyage over was difficult for people. People were in crowded conditions. Many people were seasick the whole time, especially if you were in steerage, you know, the lower class part of it. It took about 3 weeks in most cases for people to get across the ocean. The part where she settles in Eau Claire is accurate. I have been told that they immigrated through Canada.
Ah,
so
okay.
Those records are a little bit harder to find. But in the book, I have them coming on by train to Eau Claire. And, you know, getting off in Eau Claire and finding a very, very different kind of city or town than she was used to in Norway. And she, you know, mentions to Charles, who is her sister's fiance, well, where's the water? Because she's lived on the ocean and near the water, and Norway is full of water. And he said, oh, we have the Great Lake. We have the Big Lake up north. So she hadn't seen Lake Superior yet, obviously, so.
Is there a question in particular you really regret not knowing about her?
Well, I certainly regret not knowing about what her life was like, but I suspect I know that's what it was. I'd also be very, very curious to see if she was what she was diagnosed with. Mm-hmm. The diagnoses I put in the book are fiction, but some of the diagnoses for the other people in the book are not fiction. And she meets a poet when she's in Eau Claire, who's actually based on a real character who was, in fact, judged in Eau Claire, went through a trial and deemed to be insane and sent to Mendota Hospital.
I also wonder if you consulted church ledgers, which can also be a really valuable source for researching family ancestry.
Yes, that's a really good question. I actually had a friend who, because we knew about the Blair Trempolo connection, a friend in my book club who did some church record searching there was not able to find anything. I looked, my relatives went to Grace Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, her sister would have, and I wasn't able to find anything through that either. So that continued to lead to sort of dead ends on every angle I took. And I did call the State Historical Society too, and they were also helpful in that they were unable to find anything as well. And again, reiterated what the National Archives has said is that, you know, a lot of asylum records have been destroyed.
So you have the birth certificate, you have the blue trunk, which is so treasured in your life, but you also have a poem that you discovered. Can you read the poem for us?
Yes, she. So this was a poem she wrote in the autograph book. And the thing that's so fascinating about that autograph book is that Henry obviously was a Norwegian immigrant because a lot of the signatures in it are in Norwegian. But Marit's signature is in this beautifully calligraphied writing in English, the same calligraphy that's on her trunk. So I know that when she was here, she was writing and functioning as a pretty sane human being. So I'm curious about that. But she had written this poem to Henry, and the poem's called The Waiting Time, and it's by Sarah Doudney, who is a British author, actually lyricist. She wrote hymns more than anything else, but I'll read it to you because it's quite beautiful. Youth and love are oft impatient, seeking things beyond your reach. But the heart grows sick of hoping ere it learns what life can teach. For before the fruit be gathered, we must see the blossoms fall. And the waiting time, my friend, is the hardest time of all.
Oh, that's so pretty. And I love how time is captured in the poem as well, because you have to go through time in order to be able to find bits and pieces of your ancestry and of Marit's life.
You know, it gave me a little bit of a peek into her personality a bit, because I, you know, like I said, I didn't know her and didn't get much information about her, but clearly she was interested in poetry. Clearly she was a romantic, and I don't know if she was writing the poem to Henry or just to whoever, but it gave me a peek into her life, and to see her actual writing was so powerful to me, because I was like, she held this, she wrote this, and that was quite meaningful.
Does it compel you to do more writing like The Blue Trunk?
Yes. In fact, I've already started on my next novel. My aunt, so this would have been Marit's great niece, was in the Women's Air Corps in World War II. She flew planes from, you know, she was a WASP. She flew planes across the United States. And part of what people don't know either is that they did a lot of things other than that. They would often put a sleeve on the back of their plane and along like a kite type thing, almost a long sleeve. And they would fly over military bases, and the men, artillerymen, would shoot at the sleeve for target practice. And occasionally they would shoot the plane. And there were just under 2,000 WASPs, and 38 of them died in service to the country. There's been a few books that have been written about it, but I want to go back and do a little bit more with her. And mainly I want the book to be about friendship between these four women who went through this. But also, I think their story, similar to what Kristen Hanna has done with the women in Vietnam, I think their story needs to be told and needs to be remembered. They didn't have military benefits. My aunt got the Congressional Medal of Honor posthumously after her death. So I think that's a story that needs to be told as well.
Oh, that's fascinating as well. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's so good to be here, and I really enjoyed talking to you today.
Anne Lowry is author of the new novel, The Blue Trunk, which is based on the experiences of her great-great-aunt Marit Sletmo. Her upcoming talk, it's part of the Dirty Laundry Genealogy Series at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library. It is set for November 14th at 6 p.m. On a future program, we'll be learning about how to make informed decisions in buying, owning, and maintaining a car with the author of The Mechanic Shop, Femme's Guide to Car Ownership. And we want to hear about your relationship with cars. What do you wish you had known when you bought your first car? Do you go back to the same mechanic again and again? And how did you find them? And what was it like to let go of your first car? Mine was a Chevy Nova, and you had to move on to another one. As we talk about all phases of car ownership, share your story, call or text us at 888-642-0232, or email about your vehicle's memorable moment. Feel free to include a picture or two at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That email again is wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.